Support for the Exchange podcast from NHPR comes from you, our subscribers, and from
Dartmouth Hitchcock. Imagine nationally ranked healthcare in your community with convenient locations throughout northern New England. World-class providers are closer than you think. Visit dartmouthhitchcock.org to learn more. Dartmouth Hitchcock is here. And from
the Elm Street Group at Morgan Stanley, working with clients to create enduring financial value and a lasting impact through sustainable investing solutions. A local wealth management team with global insights. Find out more at theelmstreetgroup@morganstanley.com.
From New Hampshire Public Radio, I'm Laura Kanoy, and this is The Exchange. More than four decades ago, in June 1971, President Nixon declared a war on drugs.
America's public enemy number one in the United States is drug abuse. In order to fight and defeat this enemy, it is necessary to wage a new all-out offensive.
Since then, the nation's gone back and forth on this topic. In the 1980s and 90s, the tough-on-crime approach prevailed. In more recent years, the nation's seen a softening of marijuana laws and a greater focus on addiction treatment. But which way is the pendulum swinging now? Earlier this month, the new U.S. Attorney General Jeff Sessions weighed in, urging heavier penalties. And at the federal and state level, our criminal justice system still struggles with what the best approach should be. Today in The Exchange, where do we stand on the so-called war on drugs? Let's hear from you. The Exchange number is 1-800-892-6477. 1-800-892-NHPR. Email exchange@nhpr.org. Respond on Facebook or Twitter at NHPR Exchange. We have four guests with us. In studio, Anna Battle is here. She works at Hope on Haven Hill in Rochester, a treatment center for pregnant women and new moms. Anna herself is in recovery from heroin addiction. And Anna, it's really nice to meet you. Thank you so much for being here.
Thank you for having me.
Also with us, Behzad Mir Hashem, Assistant Professor of Law and Director of the Criminal Practice at UNH Law. And Behzad, it's good to have you too. Thank you for your time.
Thank you.
Also with us, Pat Conway. She's Rockingham County Attorney, responsible for prosecuting felonies in her county. And Pat, good to meet you too. Thank you.
Thank you.
And also with us, John Farley. He's Acting U.S. Attorney, New Hampshire's Chief Federal Law Enforcement Officer. And John Farley, thank you for your time. We appreciate it.
I appreciate the opportunity to be here.
Well, and John, I want to start with you, actually. How do you feel about that phrase, the war on drugs? How does that hit your ears today?
Well, I think it's something of an oversimplification. I mean, I think there is truly a battle going on against drugs, but it's two-pronged. There is the effort to get people to stop using drugs, and there's the effort to try to stop people from selling drugs and from preying on the addiction that people are suffering from. And I think small buzz phrases can sometimes allow us to lose the nuance that is really important in dealing with a problem that's as complex as the drug problem.
What's the nuance that you want us to remember or to think about?
Well, I think that when you're talking about the individuals who are suffering from addiction, they have a true disorder that needs to be treated and that needs to be approached as a medical problem. And we have to look at the roots of that problem, which can be varied, including mental illness issues that are basically being self-medicated by drug use. On the other hand, we have people in the community who are basically greedy and taking advantage of these individuals and preying upon them and trying to profit from their suffering. And those are the drug dealers who we at the U.S. Attorney's Office and our federal, state, and local partners are looking to take off the streets in order to protect the community.
We hear so often when we talk about this on The Exchange, John, people email and call and they say the war on drugs has failed. We need a new approach. How do you feel about that?
Well, I don't know that you can say that it has failed. I think that it is something that is ongoing and will probably never end. But we are certainly in a very bad spot right now. We have mounting deaths resulting from fentanyl. We have a community that is really suffering. And I think what's happened as a result of the fentanyl problem is there's really been an eye-opening that this is a broader problem, that we can't simply just prosecute people and put them in jail. We need to look at the root causes, such as why are people using drugs? Why are they starting? What is it that's motivating people to do that, even though they see the body count mounting every day. What's going on? And I think that we are, as a society, certainly in New Hampshire, really taking that step back and taking a broader approach, which I think is very important.
And I want to ask you about this because you have personal experience with addiction and also ending up in jail or in prison because of that. What's your just gut reaction when you hear that phrase, the war on drugs?
It's a sad concept, the war on drugs, because it makes me feel like it's a war on people, like it's a war on our own people who are suffering with the disease of substance use disorder. So when I hear it, and just from my experience in incarceration and through addiction, there's no rehabilitation. There's not much rehabilitation available in our jail systems. So I know that there are, and through different counties, there are drug courts. There are you know, the supervision programs. But when you're actually in there and in the mindset, how am I going to get well around a bunch of sick people? So it's important for people to look at people as having a disease like John was saying, a mental illness, rather than a moral issue. So I do hear that we can't arrest our way out of this a lot, but I'm also a firm believer of people being accountable for their actions. So if we do need incarceration, what do we need inside our jails that is going to help stop the recidivism rate?
So it's not so much you have a problem with incarceration or arresting people who are involved in drug-related crimes. It's what happens after.
Right, exactly. It's where do you go from here?
Can you tell us your own story, Anna, with this?
Sure. I suffer with substance use disorder. I'm in long-term recovery. But what got me there, you know, I've been to detoxes, rehabs, jails, prison. And none of that was a stopper until I was myself ready to accept help. I was actually lucky enough to have a private insurance plan where I could go to a treatment right away. I did not have to wait on a waiting list. And I stayed in treatment where I was indicted for drug charges. I was in a different state. I got well. I spent almost a year down in Florida, and then I came back up to New Hampshire and did prison time for a drug-related offense. I had asked I was working with a lawyer, obviously, and I had asked the prosecutor if I could have drug court, which I know was a program. I'm not sure. I think it was kind of new at this point.
This is a couple years ago.
Yeah.
Yeah.
And
drug courts are not up and running, you know, everywhere, so.
Absolutely, absolutely. So I was denied the drug court. I was pregnant at the time with my son, and I was denied the drug court because they felt that I did not need it. It didn't go much further from there. I was at a point in my sobriety where I really could accept consequences for my actions. I was accountable for what I had done, and I went in with a mindset of, like I said, of accepting, rather than other times going into jails, you know, previous years before I had received any treatment for substance use disorder, where I went in angry, blaming, you know, everything is everybody else's fault. That was kind of my thing. That's a symptom of our disease. So I was lucky enough to be able to finish. I got a 1 to 3 prison sentence, 1 to 3 years. And I was lucky enough to be able to finish my sentence on the administrative home confinement bracelet after a few months, and could have my son not in prison. But I was not the only pregnant woman in prison, and not everybody was that lucky.
Well, and as I said, you work at Hope on Haven Hill today in Rochester, a treatment center for pregnant women.
Yes.
So we'll definitely get back to that issue. But Pat, I want to bring you into this too. You know, broad thoughts first on all these catchphrases that we hear. You know, the war on drugs has failed, we can't arrest our way out of this problem. How do these hit you?
Well, I agree with most of the comments that were made so far from my colleagues sitting around the table. I happen to like the phrase war on drugs, and the reason I like the phrase, it's not because I feel that it's a war against people, because I understand that people are suffering. We have a drug court in Rockingham County. I participate in that program not weekly. I have a drug court prosecutor who handles it every week, but I do stand in from time to time. And I've heard the stories and the struggles, and I know it's real. And it's definitely a medical problem. I like the phrase because drugs are devastating our community. And we need to come together as a community, not just as law enforcement officials and police officers, but as a community against drugs and fight this epidemic. Because if we don't do it as a community, it's not going to work. And that sort of goes to the phrase, we can't arrest our way out of the problem. I think arrest and holding people accountable is part of the piece of the puzzle. But there's so much more than that in terms of treatment and aftercare programming. We don't have much aftercare programming as well. So if someone goes to detox for 28 days or whatever it may be, when they get out, there's nowhere to go. And they may not have any supports in place, so they fall back into what they were doing before. So it is a very complicated problem. But I do like the phrase because I think it shows and demonstrates that this is very serious. And we need to come together as a community, just like we would if there was a war, and you know, support our troops and really come together and fight the problem.
It was so interesting to hear Anna say that she didn't have a problem with, you know, being arrested, taking responsibility. But then once you're inside, you know, not much really happens.
I think where New Hampshire is getting better, but there needs to be more improvement. I can tell you that in Rockingham County, in the jail, we have the STAR program, which is a substance abuse program. Some jails in New Hampshire do not have any type of programming. Stratford County has Therapeutic Community, which is a great program and sort of has been a role model for other counties in the state. I've been to that jail. I actually sat down and spoke to probably about 25 male inmates who are in that program, and they talked to me about their story and their experiences and what led them to use drugs. But it's a wonderful program that has wonderful results. So we are getting better, and I think that's the trend in New Hampshire, is to make sure we have more program when you're actually in jail or in state prison. At the state prison, we now have the FOCUS program, which is also relatively new. So I think we're getting better, but we certainly need to make more improvements.
I'd love to hear from you, Bazad, on, you know, President Nixon putting out this phrase, war on drugs. And we did see this tough on crime approach in the 70s, 80s and 90s. Just remind us what that looked like in terms of policies on the ground.
Yeah, I think it's important to recognize that the war on drugs was part of a broader war on crime. And it had a tremendous human cost and a tremendous cost in terms of individual rights. The human cost was the number of people incarcerated in this country went from around 200,000 in the early 70s to 2 million in the year 2000. And when you talk about people being locked up, you know, they lose their job, they lose their home, they lose their ties to their children, their families. And so there's been a tremendous human cost of this concept of war as a response to a social problem. But the other aspect of this is an incredible cost in terms of individual freedoms. You know, it's no accident that most of the provisions of the Bill of Rights relate to restraints on the power of government in the area of criminal prosecution. And starting in the 1970s, the federal courts, right up to the U.S. Supreme Court, really loosened restrictions on the police such that today, you know, in inner cities in the U.S., it's the norm for young African-Americans to be stopped and searched repeatedly. It's the norm for people's homes to be, you know, have their doors rammed in and searched pursuant to warrants obtained based on information from confidential informants who are themselves drug users. It's the norm on the highways of New Hampshire to be stopped for, say, speeding, and for a police officer to say, oh, I think I smell marijuana in your car, and they're going to get a drug dog and say you're staying here until you either consent to a search or we get a search warrant. There's really been a decline in the notion that individuals have privacy rights to be left alone by the government unless they're directly harming other individuals. Because now possession of any drug other than marijuana in New Hampshire is a felony. So it's a serious crime. And so there's been this great human cost and this due process cost?
We got a call, Bazad, a couple months ago from a dad whose daughter had died from a heroin overdose. And he said, you know, lock that person up for life who gave my daughter that drug. And then other people in that conversation said, nobody made your daughter take the drug. And that's, you know, that's a whole other issue of addiction and how much control you really have. But I wonder, given what you just said, how you feel about that.
I mean, the human cost of drug abuse in this country is very real. There's no question about that. It's almost as real as the human cost of alcohol and the human cost of tobacco. I mean, there are unfortunately large numbers of people who abuse substances, and that has a dramatic negative impact on their health, sometimes on their lives. The issue is whether this response of criminalizing drug possession, putting drug users in jail, putting people who are drug users themselves who sell small quantities to other people to support their own habit in prison. The issue is that an effective response? Nobody can deny the suffering of a parent. And in fact, you know, what's happened over the past 40 years is that these very real tragedies have been very effectively exploited in the political system, starting with Richard Nixon and the war on crime. Because who can be against that? Who can be against protecting the most vulnerable people in society? But the issue is, has the techniques that have been adopted, have they been effective techniques?
Lots more to talk about, but let's invite our listeners to join us as well. The exchange number, 1-800-892-6477. Send us an email, exchange@nhpr.org. Respond on Facebook or Twitter at NHPR Exchange. Today in the exchange, we're looking once again at the idea of where we are at as a society, how we feel about the phrase, the war on drugs. Give us a call, 1-800-892-6477. We'd love to hear from you. Send us an email, exchange@nhpr.org. Respond on Facebook or Twitter at NHPR Exchange. And all of you, to our listeners, Mark's joining us from Rochester. Hi, Mark. Go ahead. You're on the air. Welcome.
Hi. I'm 60 years old, and I've seen what drugs and the drug war have done to many people throughout my life. And I have a rather simple proposal, which doesn't affect the human cost of drug use. But, in any event, the idea is simply whenever the police find anybody with any quantity of illicit material, the materials are simply confiscated. The people are not arrested. They're not incarcerated. They're not ostracized in any way. The materials are simply confiscated, destroyed. This completely eliminates any risk involved with selling drugs, and thereby eliminates any profit in selling drugs. If there's no profit, there's no product.
Could they just get more, Mark? I mean, would that just turn into a circle? Yeah.
But the object, I mean, if I can make more money selling a loaf of Wonder Bread than I can selling an ounce of crack, I mean, which one am I going to sell?
I see where you're going. Okay, and Mark, thank you for the call. And actually, we got another email to that effect. Mike in Belmont says, prohibition creates the environment in which greedy drug sellers can profit. End prohibition, and you destroy the opportunity to profit from illegal drug sales. So kind of on the same page. What do you think, John?
Well, I don't want to comment on overall policy issues, but certainly the idea that we could simply confiscate drugs and the problem would go away, I don't think is workable. Certainly every day on the street when law enforcement officers make a traffic stop and recover drugs execute a search warrant and seize drugs, those drugs are taken off the street, but there are still plenty more out there. I think simply taking them off the street with no consequences is not going to be a solution to the problem.
Well, Mark, thank you for the call. We'll take a lot more of your calls in just a moment. The exchange number, 1-800-892-6477, as we continue our conversation with the war on drugs. Stay with us.
Hi, Hi, my name is Arielle. I'm calling from Derry.
My name is Elise. I'm from Alaska.
My name is Ina, and I'm calling from Brooklyn, New York.
From the Alaskan wilderness to the streets of New York City, NHPR Civics 101 is your guide to how American democracy works.
I had a question about term limits.
How does the Electoral College work?
Can you help me explain the National Security Council to my students?
Subscribe to the podcast and submit your questions at civics101podcast.org.
This is The Exchange. I'm Laura Kanoy. This hour, what does the phrase, the war on drugs, mean to us today? How are public attitudes and the criminal justice system changing? Let's hear from you. The Exchange number is 1-800-892-6477. Send us an email, exchange@nhpr.org. Respond on Facebook or Twitter at NHPR Exchange. Again, 1-800-892-6477. And before the break, we got a call and an email saying, you know, why don't we just legalize drugs, basically, and then you won't have people profiting from this sale. Anna, what do you think about that?
I think that I haven't done too much research on this, but I know there are some countries in the world that are highly decriminalized use of drugs. I believe that Canada even has the setup stations where you can, and I think our country is working on them, the safe stations where you can use IV drugs in safety without being arrested. And from what I've read, the overdose rates have gone down and the incarceration rates have gone down. Would that work in our country? I can't comment on that because I'm not an expert on anything like that. I do believe in a decriminalization and like a destigmatization of the disease of substance use disorder, to treat it like I'll always say, to treat it more like a disease rather than a moral issue. And if that means that we need to spend more money on hospitals and treatment centers than we do on jails, then so be it.
Well, here's an email from Anton in Manchester who says, I'd like to hear what you guys have to say about the confusing way society is addressing the drug scourge. Anton says, on the one hand, we provide drug users with syringes and safe places, and we move to legalize drugs. And then in the same breath, society laments how bad the problem is. Anton says, at the end of the day, efforts have only resulted in the problem becoming a real chore to even purchase over-the-counter cold remedies for my children. That's so that people won't create other drugs out of those cold remedy problems. Anton says, when will we finally stop taking so many disjointed individual approaches and try addressing the problem in a coordinated way from the federal government down to the local communities? Anton, thank you so much for the email. And, you know, Bazad, I think to you first, it does seem to be sort of frenetic. I mean, on the one hand, we're, you know, making a lot of arrests. On the other hand, we're saying, you know, here's some clean syringes. It does. We do seem confused.
Yeah, I mean, I think that the war on drugs is part of a larger issue of how you deal with crime. And I think, you know, there's no easy answers. Part of the problem, it seems to me, is to respond to a complicated problem like this, you need a functioning political civil system where there's real dialogue about, you know, competing complicated considerations on how to address them. And instead, for three or four decades, drugs and crime more generally were used as a way for politicians to get votes. So there hasn't been, you know, a lot of thoughtful discussion where people from different perspectives can come together and try to figure out how to address this problem. So, I mean, my own thinking, and I perfectly understand that other people may disagree with this, is that drug use should be treated as a public health and social issue. When you take someone who's using drugs and you put them in a jail cell, and then release them 30, 60 days later with their job gone, their family ties gone, that really doesn't further any desirable social goal.
So you're saying it hurts society and the person more than it helps.
Criminalizing drug use and possession. When you're talking about sale and whether it should be regularized, whether it should stay criminal, I think that's a more complicated problem, just like the sale of alcohol. You know, people look at prohibition as this sort of awful backward period, but in fact, during prohibition, it was sales that were criminalized, not individual possession. People's homes could not be searched for alcohol. So it was a more restrained response to alcohol than we have today to the drug problem, in fact.
You know, it's interesting what you say, and maybe, Pat, I'll go to you first on this. The idea that we just haven't, our policy is sort of frenetic. We haven't had a broad, thoughtful discussion on this. You have politicians at the federal level, and then people like you who work at the county level, and then we've got John working as the federal guy here in the state of New Hampshire. And then we have the U.S. attorney, you know, for the state. And there are all sorts of different philosophies and political views and so forth. And I just wonder what you think about what Bazad says and our emailer says about we're just not organized on this.
I think we're getting better. But again, I think we need to make some more improvements in terms of sitting down and talking with stakeholders from the community about the program. We do that. I do it. I've been to numerous forums over the last couple of years throughout Rockingham County to talk about the epidemic and how we can manage it in our communities. So it is being done in terms of working with the Attorney General's office and the U.S. Attorney's office. The county attorneys meet with the Attorney General's office bimonthly, and we speak of issues such as this. Also, with the U.S. Attorney's office, when Emily Rice was the U.S. attorney, she also invited the county attorneys and the attorney generals and other prosecutors and law enforcement to meet on various issues, including this important issue. So I do think we're improving, but we need to get better. The problem is increasing. And this year, 2016, about 471 people died from an overdose. 91 of those people were in Rockingham County.
Wow.
I did want to discuss a little bit the difference between alcohol and I think what we see out there now in terms of prohibition. What we're seeing now is fentanyl, carfentanyl. Those substances can kill you if you touch it, if you breathe it in. It's a lot different than alcohol. When you take a sip of alcohol, you're not necessarily going to die. We've prosecuted cases in my office where children have been subjected to drugs and may have touched it, may have ingested it, not knowing that it was dangerous. We cannot legalize these drugs. We cannot do that. They're too dangerous. What kind of message are we sending to our children if we legalize the drugs? That it's okay to use these drugs? I think that would be, we would be moving in the wrong direction if we did that. I also want to comment on our state troopers on the highway. I disagree that it's the norm that state troopers are essentially stomping on people's constitutional rights every single day. I disagree with that. That is not the norm. Does it happen? Yes. And when it happens, we will not go forward on a case and we'll sit the trooper down and we'll talk with them about this is what the Constitution encompasses. This is the case law. You cannot do this. And here's why. And we try to teach them about what they did wrong. But it's not the norm. And they're out there fighting for our community every single day. So I just want to make sure that people out there understand that.
What is the proper role of arrest then? And maybe this is a question for everybody. You know, you talked about the danger of these drugs, but all of you have spoken eloquently also about the scourge of addiction and how, you know, it's killing people, breaking up families, having so many negative impacts. So how do you decide, Pat, you know, when you're approached with one of these cases that arrest is appropriate in this instance, incarceration is appropriate, or this person more needs treatment?
Well, I mean, at the county attorney's office, myself and the assistant county attorneys who work for me, we look at a number of different factors. We look at the specific case, whether or not there's aggravating circumstances in the case. For instance, how much drugs were involved? Was it, you know, one hit or one use? Is it someone who's charged with possession with intent to sell, or is it someone who's charged with straight possession? Is it someone who has a long criminal history? Is it someone who suffers from substance abuse, or is it a drug profiteer, someone who does not suffer from substance abuse but is profiting off of the misery of others? Those are the things that we take into consideration. If it's someone who is selling drugs, is not addicted, and is profiting from the misery of others, then that person should go to state prison for a long time, as far as I'm concerned. If it's someone who is charged with possession and is suffering from addiction, then perhaps we go the treatment route. In Rockingham County, we have the drug court program. We have a New Hope program. We have adult diversion as well. So someone who may be charged with felony possession of heroin or whatever it may be, if they don't have a long criminal history and we think they're appropriate for the program, they go into this program, and if they complete counseling and other things that we feel is necessary in order to rehabilitate that person, that at the end of that time frame, which is usually a year, the charge will be dismissed or nil prost. So there's different avenues that we can take, and there is discretion at the state level.
Well, and speaking of discretion, we got a tweet from Dean who says, can your guests speak to the Attorney General Sessions' memo to law enforcement regarding maximum penalties for drug offenses? Will they honor it? And, you know, some people, since the Attorney General came out with this, are saying he's getting rid of prosecutorial discretion. He's getting rid of judicial discretion. Which you just outlined, Pat. And I wonder what you think about this first, John. I mean, again, you're the acting U.S. attorney. So the attorney general, whatever he says, has an impact on you and what you do.
That's correct. I mean, he's our boss. And I think you need to take a step back and understand how this process works. When we have a series of guidances that we've been provided that tell us how to exercise our discretion. But at the end of the day, your experience and your judgment are very important in any decision whether or not to charge an offense. And on the federal level, we are focusing on the drug traffickers. We don't prosecute, by and large, individuals simply for possessing drugs unless they are possessing a substantial amount of drugs that is going to be sold. That's the type of case that we handle on the federal level. We are looking for the major drug traffickers. The guidance that the department has always held is that our ordinary policy is to charge the most serious, readily provable offense. And that has really been the guidance that we have followed consistently for many, many years. Under Attorney General Holder, he had issued a memo that indicated that in certain instances, we would not seek mandatory minimum sentences for a very small subset of essentially first-time or near first-time offenders who didn't have violence, didn't have guns, weren't leaders. But what's lost in that is back in 1994, Congress passed a law that was commonly called the safety valve. And that is a law that allowed essentially low-level first-time drug offenders to get out from under a mandatory minimum sentence if they satisfied certain criteria. Many of those are the same criteria that were in Attorney General Holder's memo. So many of the folks who would have not been charged with a mandatory minimum under Attorney General Holder's memo would have not received a mandatory minimum sentence anyway under law that's been in place for over 20 years. The new memo from Attorney General Sessions said we are going to default towards charging mandatory minimum cases where they're appropriate. But he is a former federal prosecutor. The Deputy Attorney General, Rod Rosenstein, is also a longtime career prosecutor, and they understand the need for prosecutorial discretion and judgment. And his memo still provides us with the ability to look at the individual facts and circumstances of the case, and make that judgment that this is not the appropriate way to charge a particular case. All the memo indicates is that in order for an individual line prosecutor to do that, they have to have the approval of a supervisor, such as me, to review that, to make sure that the type of sentence you're seeking doesn't depend on what prosecutor has been assigned your case.
So it doesn't get rid of some of the discretion and flexibility that Pat talked about.
That's correct. I mean, there's discretion as to whether or not we charge, and there's discretion about whether how we charge that crime. And we look at all the factors that Pat discussed.
Did you want to jump in on that, Anna?
Sure. So I'd like to speak on what Dean had written us. So we live in an age of social media, right? We no longer have to go buy a newspaper to see who got arrested. And there have been, for a few years now, showing up on social media accounts, and I was on one of these articles of Granite Hammer, which was, from what I say, a few drug sales, low-level drug sales, a lot of possession. And these people's faces, including my own, are plastered on social media, of course on the news, of course on the newspaper, it is public record. So it's kind of like you're convicted beforehand. And if you read some of the comments on the social media, we're like, well, great, thanks for getting these people off the streets, lock them up, hope they rot in jail. you know, things like this. But not understanding actually what the crimes are. I've seen a lot of people on these arrests that are, you know, possession of paraphernalia, possession of marijuana even, which we had talked about before being, I believe you said it was not a felony in New Hampshire anymore.
Possession of marijuana is a misdemeanor, and actually the legislature recently passed a decriminalization bill that's awaiting the governor's signature, I think.
Right. So so I believe that the idea of having a, you know, low-level drug crime and, like we've been talking about, the people that are addicted to the drug, that are selling, you know, whatever to be able to pay for their habit, and if that includes a small amount of that drug, getting arrested for it and then being sentenced to the same prison where they're not receiving treatment for their addiction, for their underlying.
Getting back to your earlier point, right, where you said you're okay in some instances with people being arrested. Mm-hmm. It's what happens afterwards.
Absolutely.
Lots of people want to jump into our conversation. So back to the phones, and Patrick's in Merrimack. Hi, Patrick. You're on The Exchange. Welcome.
Hi, good morning.
Go ahead, Patrick.
I wanted to speak to some of our, the U.S.'s recent experience with legalizing marijuana. And one of the things we learned that I was not expecting is that people who had previously not done it started doing it. And I think the most prominent news stories were like the gummy bears that, you know, had a lot more THCs than people were expecting. And this is actually backed up by our experience in Prohibition, where people actually stopped drinking. Most people stopped drinking. One of the myths is that drinking didn't go down. It actually declined to its lowest point, certainly in the 20th century. So what that tells me is that, you know, Prohibition works on some level, but it's often not worth its cost to society. Have there ever been approaches that have focused more on demand rather than supply? We know that there will always be a supply if there's a demand. Are there any approaches that focus more on demand and perhaps even intervention before somebody arrives in court?
Patrick, thank you so much for the call. Go ahead, Bazad.
I think that my understanding is consistent with the callers, that it's true that if drugs are legalized, more people are likely to use them. The question is, does that justify the heavy-handed response of the war on drugs? Pat mentioned, you know, the dangerous substances that we're dealing with today as opposed to, say, alcohol. And one thing it reminded me of as far as alcohol is, you know, I'm originally from Iran, and after the revolution, alcohol was banned in Iran, and it's a crime. And people started making it in their homes, and they created forms of alcohol that they would go blind from drinking, you know, methyl alcohol instead of ethyl alcohol. So it's, it's a complicated problem. The other thing I just wanted to respond to, if it's okay, is, you know, Pat brought up the issue of troopers searching people on the street side. I've been a criminal defense lawyer in this state for about 25 years, and the vast majority of police and prosecutors are people who are trying to do the right thing. The issue is not the rogue trooper. The issue is possession of marijuana is a crime, and the smell of marijuana gives you probable cause to search. And so it's not that the troopers are abusing the law, it's that the law has made it easy to stop and frisk and search.
Well, maybe after a short break, we'll talk a little bit about the softening of American attitudes toward marijuana. I know you have to leave us for an important meeting, John Farley. I really appreciate you taking the time out. We'll have you back on and talk about this issue again.
It was my pleasure. Thank you, Laura.
That's John Farley, acting U.S. attorney. Again, he's New Hampshire's chief federal law enforcement officer. More of your questions and comments on the war on drugs in just a moment. Stay with us. This is The Exchange on NHPR. This is The Exchange. I'm Laura Kanoy. Today in The Exchange, where do we stand in the so-called war on drugs? What do you think? The Exchange number is 1-800-892-6477. Send us an email, exchange@nhpr.org. nhpr.org. Respond on Facebook or Twitter at NHPR Exchange. One more time, the number 1-800-892-6477. With us in studio, Anna Battle. She works at Hope on Haven Hill in Rochester, a treatment center for pregnant women and new moms. She's in recovery herself from heroin addiction. Also with us, Pat Conway, Rockingham County attorney, responsible for prosecuting felonies in her county, and Bazad Mir Hashem. He's assistant professor of law and director of the Criminal Practice Clinic at UNH Law. Again, the number 1-800-892-6477. And all of you, let's go right back to our listeners. And Marie is in Keene. Hi, Marie. You're on the air. Welcome.
Thank you. Well, I'm a professor at Keene State College, and I've taught probably thousands of young people over 15 years. And four of them were addicted to drugs that, you know, that I knew about. I think they were in treatment programs, but it didn't always work out, and some of them came to sad ends. And I have to say, they were among the people that I really liked the most. They were very intelligent, and they were very sensitive. My doctor mentioned that to me, too, that the people who are addicts tend to be extremely sensitive. I think we're looking at this a little bit wrong, because I work with young people. I see what they need is access to jobs and access to education. They need some sense that our society wants them in it. Because on the one hand, we say we don't want you to take drugs. But on the other hand, we say we have nothing for you to do, so go to your room and get on the internet and don't bother us. And that's, I think, the mixed message. Now, I know that some kids start getting addicted when they are in high school and they come home between 3 p.m. and 7 p.m. and no parent is there because their parents both work.
Marie, thank you for the call. And it's real interesting. She said, you know, young people need something to do. They need a role in society. They need to know that they're important. And then they won't turn to drugs, hopefully. I wonder what you think, Anna, given your own experience with this.
So I've actually spoken on a few panels about this, about prevention for youths. And I always say the same thing. I think that, and I know that nowadays there are actually some clubs that are, I think Dover has Youth to Youth, which is a wonderful program. But there needs to be something that's like cool or fun to be able to do as a youth rather than hang with the crowd that's going to be doing the drugs. Because from my own experience, I find that like if that's what I was going to do, then I would stick with those people and everybody else doing other things rather than school clubs or school sports. Because in my own experience, I wasn't like a team sport person. I wasn't athletic like that. I also wasn't interested in like the Latin clubs or the math clubs or anything. But I would have been interested in like doing something in the community, right? Like I love animals, so I would love to like I would have been interested in a club where you could like volunteer different places with animals or and it didn't have to necessarily be in the school. It could just have been in my community. And instead, I kind of went a different way. In my own experience, I did go a different way. But I do believe in like having like sober like peers, like, you know, almost like a big brother, big sister program. But like somebody maybe in their 20s who is in sobriety or is sober or just never touched a drink or a drug. Being able to work with these youth and being like, this is, you don't have to go out and do this. Like, you don't have to be, you know. You don't have to be like that uncomfortable in your skin where you need to go out and try drugs and alcohol. These are other things you can do. These are other alternatives.
Bazad, what do you think?
I just want to say, following up on the caller and the comment here, that there is an uncomfortable truth here that we do need to acknowledge, which is that just like there's plenty of people who use alcohol socially and don't have problems with it, there are plenty of people who use drugs and don't end up having problems with it. There is a fraction, and I don't think we know how large it is, who do end up having serious problems. You know, there's plenty of research in this area, you know, looking at factors in those people's backgrounds. And this one-size-fits-all criminal approach makes no distinction between those two groups. It's simply not true that every person who smokes marijuana has a problem. They're engaging in activity that I don't engage in, but it's arguably much less harmful than plenty of other activities that people engage in. And they have a right to be left alone unless they are harming other people. And that's a concept that's been lost in this war on drugs as well.
Well, there is the concept, too, that you know, if you take some of these drugs, you may harm someone else if you get out in a car and so forth. So there's that desire to prevent that harm from spreading from not just yourself but into the wider society.
Well, I mean, driving under the influence of alcohol is a crime, and driving under the influence of drugs is a crime as well. But it seems like driving under the influence of alcohol is a much more dangerous thing than driving under the influence of at least some drugs. Again, that's not something I'm in any way encouraging. I'm just saying that you have to be open to the possibility that every person who recreationally uses drugs doesn't need to be prosecuted, doesn't need to be incarcerated, unless he's engaging in behavior that's harmful to others, or at least to himself.
How do you feel, this gets us into what I wanted to talk about, Pat, how do you feel about the broader societal relaxation around marijuana laws? You know, I think New Hampshire is pretty soon going to be surrounded by states that have legalized marijuana.
I have two kids. I have a 17-year-old who's going to be going to Keene State College actually next year. And I have a daughter who just turned 11 today. So it scares me. You know, I understand all the arguments for relaxing the laws with marijuana, and I'm not necessarily against decriminalization, which could potentially make marijuana a violation level offense. You know, in reality, in district courts across the state, if someone is charged with possession of marijuana, generally speaking, those particular crimes are being placed on file without a finding, meaning that a year goes by, and if you're not in trouble for a year, it gets dismissed. Or they're being diverted to some sort of a diversion program, and they're not being convicted necessarily of a Class A misdemeanor, but perhaps a violation. But again, I worry about the message that we're sending to our kids. And, you know, the brain, from what I understand in terms of the formation of a child's brain, it doesn't form until at least 25 years old, and I've heard with males it's even longer. No offense. but marijuana can affect that. It can substantially affect your brain, a person's brain who is developing. So it scares me, but I understand that someone who smokes marijuana may not have a problem with it, and maybe something that they do recreationally, and I understand that as well. So there's sort of a push and a pull there, and I have mixed feelings about it, but I am pro-decriminalization.
Interesting. I wonder what you think about this, too, Anna. You know, as we talk about this war on drugs and so forth, there is a broader relaxation towards marijuana that in the 70s, when President Nixon declared this war, would have been, you know, unthinkable. How do you view this? I've heard other people who struggle with addiction to say that marijuana was their gateway, to use another well-worn phrase. Some people struggling with addiction say, you know, no, it's completely in a class by itself. I just wonder what you think.
So for me personally, I don't use any substance because I cannot use any substance in safety. But that, like Pazad said, like that's not everybody's case. There is a lot of people that can use marijuana in safety. There's people that can use alcohol in safety. And I don't mean that they can drive in safety under the influence of that. But I don't believe that it, in my experience, it was a gateway for me. I believe that, like, I suffered from the disease before I picked up a drink or a drug. And I think a lot of people who actually have the disease can really agree with that.
You had a predilection for addiction.
Addictive behaviors long before I picked up. And just the use of a substance is absolutely just a symptom of the disease. There's a whole lot of other things that go along with it. But I just wanted to mention quickly too about harm reduction in our society. I think we had talked about it earlier a little bit. Didn't really get into it. Somebody had written about, oh, we have these needle exchanges, but then we say our problem is so bad. So we're having like an outbreak of infectious diseases, hepatitis C, HIV. And it's mostly coming from needles. If we make the needles harder to get, they are actually going to be still used, but more diseases are going to be spread. They're going to be used among other people. So I'm a true firm believer that we should have a needle exchange. We should have a safe station program where people can use IV drugs in safety. And also And I'm a huge fan, obviously, of Narcan, and the fact that it is so readily available nowadays is a huge blessing.
So harm reduction, again, and we've done programs on this, but this is where, you know, you may say, look, I don't like the fact that you're using heroin, but I also don't want you to get hepatitis C or spread AIDS or die on the street. Mm-hmm. So this is why we have these other avenues for you. It's controversial, though, isn't it, Anna?
Absolutely. It's very controversial because on one hand, it's like, well, if you have this hypodermic needle on you, you can get arrested. On the other hand, it's like, please take this free, clean hypodermic needle so you don't spread a disease. And here's this Narcan. And there's a lot of controversy about the Narcan. Why is it free when we know it's not free? But why is it free? I've seen something going around. How come cancer treatment isn't free, but Narcan is? Well, because Narcan's not a treatment for the disease.
It's just to bring you back.
It's
from
just to bring you back
the edge
to
of
life,
death.
Just like the heart paddles.
Here's an email that came in from Carla, who says research shows police departments would need to shrink 40% to 50% if the war on drugs ended. She said policing for profit, whereby police can take innocent people's property without them ever being charged with a crime, creates a financial incentive for police departments to continue the war on drugs. Nashua's police chief recently said his department got $400,000 from this practice. Carla says, why not use this asset forfeiture money and even grant it hammer money for harm reduction programs like safe stations instead of amping up the war on drugs? The war on drugs, she says, is a war on people and it needs to end. Wow, there's a lot there. Thank you, Carla. Pat, what do you think?
Well, I do think we need more money for treatment and things of that nature. However, the police need money to do their jobs. And when we're talking about doing surveillance on, and I'm talking about big time drug dealers, I'm not talking about low level or mid level drug dealers. In order to conduct surveillance, in order to follow through with those investigations, you need manpower. You need men and women out there working, and they're going to be working overtime. This is not a 9-to-5 job. It's a job that you're literally doing 24/7. So the reality is, you know, they need money to fulfill their role in our community, which is to, you know, police the community and to arrest folks, especially those high-level drug dealers. And the reality is they need money to do that. I don't think we just defund them and take their money away so that they cannot complete that responsibility. And I think that that role is very important in fighting this drug epidemic in our community.
How do we figure out, maybe I'll turn to you, Bazad, how do we figure out who is that big-time drug dealer and who is, you know, he or she also addicted and is just dealing to make money for that addiction?
You know, for me, the big-time drug dealer is like the mastermind criminal. You know, it's an image that serves a useful purpose. This really goes back to the issue that you brought up earlier of discretion. You know, police prosecutors have a lot of discretion, and how they exercise it is critical. You know, a police officer sees a young person who looks like he's smoking a joint, and the kid flicks it off into a stream, say. The officer can let it go, or he can charge that person with felony falsifying physical evidence. That's a point of discretion for a police officer. Then a prosecutor reviews that case. He or she can decide to bring that charge or not bring that charge. And large scale, the reality is that discretion has been exercised in the system to the great detriment of poor people and people in minority communities. Again, the problem is not the individual horrible police officer who goes after poor people or black people, but there are certain structural forces in play such that the war on drugs has devastated certain communities. You know, it's interesting. If you go back in the 80s and 90s, the war on drugs had great support in the black community because they thought it would make their neighborhoods safer. But coupled with the over-enforcement of drug laws has been the under-enforcement of protection against violence in these communities. And I think that You know, it's a lot easier to set up one drug user to go sell drugs to another drug user and, you know, you get 2 felony arrests out of it than to really solve some beating on a street. And the issue with police, I think, partly is, are the resources really going where the needs are greatest in these communities? Or is the war on drugs really sucking all of the resources away from areas of violence and public safety where there may be a greater need for law enforcement?
And that seems to be Carla's point. And Carla, thank you for the email. But on this issue of discretion, you know, it's interesting, Bazaar. We talked about it earlier in the context of it's good for, you know, the criminal justice system to have discretion to figure out, you know, who really needs treatment and who really should be locked up because they're a threat and so forth. It sounds like from what you're saying now, though, that sometimes discretion is not a good thing because we do see what, you know, a lot of people call mass incarceration of minorities and low-income people. So this sounds oversimple, but is discretion good or bad?
Well, I think that is oversimple because it depends on who's exercising discretion and what criteria guide that person's exercise of discretion. So with, you know, mandatory minimum drug sentences, you know, individual prosecutors would decide who to charge in the federal system. And once charged, the judge would have no control over what sentence that person would receive. So I would say that's an example of poor discretion. On the other hand, Pat was describing a prosecutor in a marijuana case deciding to resolve a case without getting a conviction. That's great. But there are courts in this state where they don't do that. You still get the conviction, and for a second conviction, they threaten you with jail time for possession of marijuana. So when you have a lot of discretion, who holds that discretion is also something that needs to be carefully considered.
All right. And it sounds like a topic for a whole other show. We'll leave it there. And Bazaar, thank you very much for being here. I appreciate it.
You're welcome.
That's Bazaar Mir Hashem, Assistant Professor of Law at UNH Law. Anna Battle, it was good to meet you. Thank you.
Thank you so much for having me.
Anna Battle, she works at Hope on Haven Hill, a treatment center for pregnant women and new moms. And Pat Conway, thank you for taking time out. I really appreciate it.
Thank you for having me.
Pat Conway, Rockingham County Attorney, responsible for prosecuting felonies in her county. This is The Exchange on NHPR.
The views expressed in this program are those of the individuals and not those of NHPR, its Board of Trustees, or its underwriters. Hey, if you like what you heard, spread the word. Please give us a review on iTunes to help other listeners find us. And thanks.